music from Selah. The song is called Hope of the Broken World. It's 10 minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road, and so we welcome Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times to the studio. Of course, David's here. I'm here. We're going to talk about honor shame this morning. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, based in Columbia, Maryland, just on the very edge of Washington. And the ministry that's been around for, you're 15, 20 years now, huh, Doug?
From about the year 2000.
Okay, well, 15 years then.
Yeah.
And it's really a wide-ranging ministry, because Doug does a prison ministry. He travels to churches all around the country presenting Bible Alive seminars and seminars along various themes, kind of along with the liturgical calendar, for example. He's coming up to Minnesota here at the end of March for the last days of Jesus, the greatest story never told. We're looking forward to that, as well as making disciples Jesus' way. And the essence of everything that they do at Preserving Bible Times is reconstituting the context of either first century Israel, and now he's added first century Roman Empire to the context of Paul's writings. And when he does that, and he graces us with his presence on Wednesdays, we learn so much. Just opening that book, we learn so much about what's been there all along, but we just couldn't see it. Now we can. So, Doug, welcome. Glad to have you this morning. You had a breakfast in Phoenix. Now, you mentioned this to us a few weeks ago, but it turns out that this is kind of a 7.0 on the Richter scale for the ministry for Preserving Bible Times. Tell us about that breakfast and what the result has been thus far.
Well, actually, that day had a breakfast and a lunch that set two balls in motion that are continuing to roll. But starting with the first one, a friend of mine invited me to breakfast with Werner Mitzke from Mission One, and he had just published a new book called The Global Gospel, in which he was articulating the fact that the Western legalistic for spiritual laws approach to presenting justification, evangelism in the West doesn't always register to Middle Eastern, Asian cultures that are based in honor and shame. And so that was like a new thought for me. And immediately, once I saw that motif, I saw how it just permeates the Gospels, and it's now yet another lens to view passages on. For example, we're about to enter into the last week of the life of Jesus, when he called the Jewish establishment a brood of vipers. What did he do when he sent that? He shamed them publicly. And in an honor-shame culture in the Middle East, which it's a zero-sum game, okay, the only way I can get my honor back is by shaming you. So that's a whole other layer as to why Jesus died on a cross and why Passion Week turned out the way it is. The establishment had to take him down. The only way to restore their honor, at least in their own eyes, because Jesus had shamed them in the eyes of their public. Mm-hmm. So this notion of honor and shame just drips through the Gospels, and I'm told it really pervades Paul's Roman world as well, although I've got to do some homework on that.
Now, has Werner Mitzke's book been published?
It is.
It's yep. A done deal. It's out there. Because I'm in my readings, I'm seeing this honor-shame issue popping up all over the place all of a sudden.
Well, I had the same reaction. It's like poor example here, but it's like kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, it's just popping up all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's like it's finally gained traction and it's finally gone mainstream and the lights are going on. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. The primary emphasis has been honor-shame cultures in third world countries, Middle Eastern countries, Asian countries, but I think perhaps the real pastoral discovery here is going to be how shame is part of our Western evangelical world, and we've been failing to deal with it.
Oh, we probably didn't recognize it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we've defined sin as guilt and shame, That's the theoretical definition as well as the theological definition. But we've left shame behind and just focused on guilt here in the West. And from a practical point of view, there's a lot of Western evangelical people who are still dealing with unresolved issues of shame because the church really hasn't put that into focus.
Is this akin maybe to the difference between the law and the spirit of the law?
Well, the law certainly part of it. You know, the Campus Crusade people picked it up with the four spiritual laws perspective that invokes a courtroom and a judge and an advocate and a person in the dock, you know, mm-hmm. you and I, and the judge declares us to be innocent. That's the guilt-innocent motif of Western evangelicalism.
But I'm thinking, I misspoke, really. I mean, the difference between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, because I see a parallel kind of separation there, a change in color from one to the other, and the same thing strikes me as applying to guilt versus shame.
Well, I would say, in terms of spirit and letter of the law, the focus is still the law. It's how you view the law. Mm-hmm. And when we deal with honor and shame, we're really dealing with two separate issues here, one of guilt and one of shame. They're very different dynamics. One has much more emotional connotations to it. And the reason I found this subject absolutely intriguing is when Werner said during our three-hour time together on that Monday morning, guilt tends to produce productive responses from people, i.e. they ask for forgiveness or they seek reconciliation. But he says shame tends to evoke destructive behaviors in people. And so they fall into addictions and obsessions and very counterproductive behavior trying to deal with this issue of shame that we in the church really haven't been very helpful to them as shepherds to deal with this issue that's always been there. But we have just put the emphasis on one of the two pieces of sin, guilt, and really have let the shame issue just roll over to the ditch on the other side of the road, unresolved, undealt with. And therein, I think, lies the opportunity for some real pastoral breakthroughs.
Now, Werner Mitschke did kind of a study of Scripture, too, didn't he, in identifying honor, shame versus sin, guilt kind of issues. What was the balance on that?
2-1 in favor of honor, shame issues as a theme,
so
as a
preponderance
motif
of honor, shame issues, yeah.
Over innocence and guilt themes. Mm. So, you know, when I made the statement, it permeates Scripture. It's absolutely true, the honor, shame motif. It's just that the pair of glasses we've been wearing or the hearing aids we've been using here in Western evangelicalism have not been attuned to that frequency. So, I mean, that's really exciting to realize that there's actually a bigger gospel than we have been sharing with people. And that's exciting to really share the full-orbed, three-dimensional gospel of Jesus. Which, you know, is bigger than perhaps our Western evangelical understanding of the good news here in many Western perspectives.
How does this address the conflict, now an age-old conflict, between Christianity and Islam?
Well, let me answer it from a global perspective and then give a specific anecdote on that. In the Middle East, honor and shame is a zero-sum game, okay? I try to envision that as a teeter-totter, whereas if one part of the teeter-totter goes down, the other half of the teeter-totter must go up, okay? And so in a zero-sum game, if I lose my honor, you've increased yours. But if I have absorbed shame, then your honor has gone up, all right? So in a zero-sum honor-shame game, the people in the Palestinian people in Israel feel that they have been shamed because, in their viewpoint, Israel came along and just took control of their land and pushed them off the land and shamed them. Okay. Now, in a zero-sum game, the only way I can get my honor back is if I take you down. And so this is one of the intractable issues in the Middle East, is it's a zero-sum honor-shame game, where if I win, you lose. And what's really needed there is the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is win-win. Mm-hmm. In other words, I will take your shame from you and honor you. I will take it to the cross, but I will also emerge victorious with my honor intact on Resurrection Day.
That also explains why compromise is simply not a productive approach.
If your worldview is a zero-sum honor-shame game, absolutely. And that's why if biblical shalom is going to reign in the Middle East, it's because we have discovered the win-win gospel of Jesus Christ. Not being locked into the honor-shame zero-sum game of the Middle Eastern culture. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
It's a Friday afternoon. We're in Israel. We've just finished up lunch, and we're up in the Galilee. We want to go to the Arbel Cliffs, which is probably the highest viewpoint that you can go up there on a national park and overlook the whole Sea of Galilee. And I like to do a geography lesson of the Sea of Galilee while up there on the Arbel Cliffs. Well, Friday is Shabbat, and the national parks tend to close an hour earlier than usual on Shabbat. And to make sure that everyone's out of the park by, say, 3 o'clock, they actually lower the gate at 2 o'clock and not let any more people in. Well, we're kind of tight on time in our bus, so our Jewish tour guide calls the ticket booth of the Arbel Cliffs and saying it's going to be nip on tuck for time, but we hope to be able to get there at least within 5 minutes of 2 o'clock on either side. Do us a favor and keep it open, because we got a busload of people there who want to have the Arbel Cliffs experience. Well, we pull up to the ticket booth at like 2:04 in the afternoon, and it's all shut up. And so our tour guide calls the number again, and nobody answers. So he says, well, out of the bus, we'll just keep the bus on this side of the gate here. We'll walk through the gate and go up to the cliffs and just make sure that we're out of here by 3 o'clock when everything else closes up at the visitor center. So we did that, and we're leaving the ticket booth, and we're walking, you know, maybe a fifth of a mile up to where the visitor center is in the gift shop. And a person comes out of that building. And it's an Arab, okay? He's the custodian of the place, screaming at our Israel guide, articulating, felt like a violent conversation, just almost lost control. Get out of here, was basically what he was saying. You're not entitled to be here. And our guy said, look, I tried to call you, but you wouldn't answer the phone. And we'll certainly be out of here by 3 o'clock when you're going to button this place up and go home. It's no big deal. Oh, yes, it is. You cannot be here. Get out of here. And there was this screaming, mostly from the Arabic side, and our Israel guide was trying to be reasoned in his response. This is about basic hospitality. This is our country. You know, we want these people to love Israel and to have the Israel experience. I mean, let's not get hung up over 4 minutes here. And he would not let go. And it got ugly. And so our guide said, we're going up to the top. So we did. And as we walked up there, he was trailing behind us, still hollering and yelling. And when we came back down, there were the police. And so the police took our Israeli guide and this Arabic custodian person into the visitor center, and basically we found out later that the police said, you know, we're not getting involved in this. I mean, this isn't even worthy. What's the big deal here? And the Arabic custodian would not let it go. So he then called the park police as opposed to the civil police, kept us all there, and the park police came and had the same discussions all over again, and basically he insisted, the custodian did, that the park police write up our Israeli guide for a $200 fine, okay? Which as soon as I heard that, I passed the hat in the bus and we had $200 collected quickly, so we covered the fine. But there in a microcosm was honor and shame in the Middle East, okay? By violating my understanding of the rules, you have shamed me. I cannot be shamed. I have to take you down. Mm. No sense of grace, no sense of hospitality, no sense of a spirit of accommodation that these are people who traveled from America and want to appreciate the land of Israel. It was just an Arab-Jew confrontation because I'm in control, I'm theoretically right, and you're going to buckle to my way of doing things or you're going to pay a price. And there, in a nutshell, was what I thought was a microcosm of the Arab-Jewish issue wrapped around honor and shame.
Well, how is this honor-shame issue then affecting what you do at Preserving Bible Times? What kind of changes do you anticipate because of this this discovery, this aha moment of yours?
You know, all the stories I've been telling for quite some time, the passages of Scripture, Simon and the great catch of fish, the leper, the paralytic, Levi, the shame motif permeates all of those passages. It's just that I have not been doing a very good job of identifying it and pulling it out. And so now that's what I'm starting to do. I'm revisiting all those passages, and there's yet another layer of context that's at work. And Jesus restores people who have been shamed to a position of honor. In fact, he even invites him into, and this is another new phrase I'm starting to investigate here, into his kinship circle, the ultimate form of acceptance, of affirmation. And so, as you might expect, these stories of Jesus' encounters with people just get richer and deeper with a whole new layer of honor, shame, contextual understanding that I frankly didn't see for at least a decade. And I'm really excited about putting that new layer in place.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a new book?
I don't know if so much a new book as I almost wish I could go back and rewrite everything I've written before.
Mm.
That's kind of the issue because it permeates everything.
Mm-hmm.
The leper in Luke 5, my goodness, you know, he's been abandoned and humiliated and rejected. But I never have actually used the word shame to tie all of those emotional dynamics together.
Mm-hmm.
And see, if we tell the story that way, it helps us in the West understand that Jesus came not just to take away our guilt, but to take away our shame. And therein starts to lie the pastoral dimensions of this theme. When I was in the prison the next night after this Monday morning breakfast, and I retold some of these stories, weaving in the honor-shame motif. And believe me, Western prisoners caught it. They understood it. They knew what it was like to have shamed their families and shamed themselves by the decisions that they had made. And they really grooved almost like never before on the depth and the breadth and the richness of these passages. So I find all of that really thrilling and exciting and looking forward to do more.
Yeah, you mentioned a lunch, too. What about the lunch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was some Monday.
Mm-hmm.
My same friend who invited me to the breakfast said, I got another lunch. It's about discipling. You want to come along? And that's a magic word for me. So I said,
yes,
sure.
It is. Yeah. Throw me in that briar patch. Yeah.
So we had lunch with a chap named Bob Moffat, who's been with Harvest International for 30 years, Third World Ministry, and he had recently been asked to bring a plenary speech presentation to the next International Holistic Ministry Conference in late spring in the greater Phoenix area. And they wanted him to talk about the demise of discipleship in the West. And through a mutual friend, he had gotten a hold of some of my reflections and had heard about my book, Making Disciples Jesus' Way, and so he wanted to chat. And so we chatted. And as the result of that, he asked me, would I be willing to facilitate some workshops as a follow-on to his plenary session at this International Holistic Ministry Conference, and to which I said, absolutely, count me in. And so we started talking about what that would look like and what the subjects would be and so on and so forth. And we pretty well buttoned that up. And I'm going to help facilitate two workshops, one on new paradigm and frameworks for biblically making disciples, and another workshop called Discipling Wisdom. And I have been working on that material ever since, refining it. And it occurred to me a week or two ago that what can I do to get people's attention to sort of kick off these workshops on making disciples Jesus's way? And so I thought, well, I'll come up with a diagnosis of Western discipleship that will be called 20 Reasons Why Discipleship Died. And I've been working on that ever since. And I pretty well got those 20 diagnostic reasons fleshed out here. I'm probably at the 95% level. And it strikes me as maybe this would be food for thought, grist for the mill, in not only to finish up today, but maybe future sessions as well, to get some feedback on the 20 reasons I chose, anyway, why Western discipleship died, and see if we can actually upgrade this thing and make it even better.
You want to tick those off for us?
Well, here's number one. Unlike Solomon, we cut the make disciples baby in half, and in so doing, created two new non-biblical words, evangelism and discipleship. That separation had adverse consequences. It allowed us to prioritize saving over discipling. Truth be told, we never did get around to do much discipling. That takes too much effort. Plus, it can be messy and frustrating, but at least we saved them.
Mm-hmm.
Ring a bell?
Yeah, it does indeed. We talked about that as the core problem with Western evangelism for some time here, that we have this notion of what it means to disciple, that is to follow, in this case to follow Jesus Christ, but not the staying power to see it through, not the commitment, not the passion perhaps.
Well, it's the hardest of the two assignments. You know, when all is said and done, it's much easier to save a person, I believe, than it is to grow them up and mature them over 30 years. Because it's a non-linear process. It's an irregular process. It's a process that comes with advances and retreats. It's one that comes with joy as well as frustrations. And you're right. It requires staying power. And in the frenetic lives that we tend to be living today in our culture, we almost have attention deficit disorder as a collective culture. And it's just hard to not only address discipling, but to see it through to its conclusion.
Well, measuring success, measuring progress in discipleship or discipling is a difficult thing. There's no objective way to do it. If I'm intent on evangelizing, I could say, well, there's one, there's another one, there's another one. I have 10 to my credit now, or my score is now 25. This is how I'm succeeding. I've succeeded with 25 people. But in making a disciple, there's no objective measurement. There's no tape measure you can apply to satisfy yourself that you're doing a good job.
I think that's true. And what I'm sensing behind the statement that you just made is we don't have a framework for how disciples are made. And therefore, it's kind of foggy to us. Are we making progress or not? That's why I think a framework, a biblical framework, having that in view for making disciples Jesus's way may be very, very helpful in making sure and helping us understand that, yes, we are making progress.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's the thesis that I'm working on, is that with a frameworks serve useful purposes. Among others, they help us ask the right questions at the right time. But that's number 19.
Yeah.
we don't have a framework for biblically how to make disciples.
Okay. Well, this is fascinating, and I know you've got a lot of work to do, and I know you're not feeling well either. I think we should give you a break here and just kind of taper off. David, before we say goodbye to you.
Yeah, can I interject one thought? And I've been trying to wrap my head around this, and I looked up the Luke story about the leper and a couple of other stories, and I'm still not there. You know, of course, that's the Lone Ranger culture we live in. But and the other thing I'm consumed with, yes, still is the trappings that went around Hillary Clinton's statement yesterday. And, you know, the location and the presentation and the accusations that she made, not just against the few reporters that were there, but I think her true message is aimed at a wider audience, a wider public, and attempting to shame everybody who has attacked her. And as far as her position is that she's just an honorable public servant trying to make her way in the world and to do what she's trying to do, and she just did this out of convenience and attempting to point fingers at people. In fact, I've even got a couple of pictures online of her pointing fingers at people and shaming people in order to reduce their honor or their hubris or their feelings that they finally got her. They finally trapped her in a corner, and they're going to bring down the Clinton machine. I don't know if I'm off base or maybe I just need a nap.
Mm. Well, it's an interesting thought. If the Middle Eastern concept of honor and shame is a closed system, a zero-sum game, mm-hmm. the only way I can get my honor back is to take yours down.
Right.
That did seem to have that dynamic in it yesterday.
Okay.
And, of course, there are different flavors of honor shame, too, because in Japan and China, it's a little bit different color, isn't it?
Well, there's saving face, which is a slightly mm-hmm. different yeah. aspect of honor and shame. But, you know, at the 80% level, most of it is still there. And then in other cultures, there's just another slice of this. It's called dignity. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are various themes by Mozart here on this honor and shame issue in different cultures. But it all points out we have to culturally sensitive and contextually aware of honor and shame at these various layers of it in these different cultures when we present the gospel of Jesus Christ that frees people up.
Well, Doug, the notion I'm most teased by here is that here in the West, and specifically in the United States of America, it just may be that honor shame is really a much bigger factor than we've ever realized. And so we keep responding on a sin guilt level, but we're not addressing honor shame within ourselves.
I can probably get in trouble by saying this, but I totally agree with that. And if we only focus on innocent guilt and not honor shame, we are promulgating a truncated gospel. Hmm. It's not the whole gospel of Jesus. And having done that in the West here pretty dramatically, we've got a lot of people in our flocks, in our pews, in our churches, in our fellowships, who are still struggling with past issues of divorce, abortion, that have shamed them, and no one's ever helped them deal with that.
Hmm. Interesting. Be interesting to see how this affects your ministry. It's certainly going to affect ours here, too, as we start thinking about that and maybe devoting some resources to that whole honor shame idea. Doug, we're grateful. Thank you for dropping by this morning.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm told that maybe you were the one that told me that Christianity Today has the feature article mm-hmm. on shame.
Yep.
So you might want to take that out and pass some of those out. I think Andy Stanley wrote it.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I think we should have our appetite whetted for investigating the ramifications of all that in what we teach and preach in this country. Doug, we'll see you next week, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doug.